9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Live from Suffolk, this is The Breakfast Show with Lizzie Swan.
Good morning, everybody. It is Thursday, the 16th of September, and a new day has dawned on education. We are absolutely delighted that you've joined us today. I'm going to be joined by Megan Mansworth today. We're going to be talking teaching to the top. So don't forget to text in, call in. We want to hear from you.
Live from Suffolk, this is The Breakfast Show with Lizzie Swan on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
So good morning, everybody. Like I say, a new day has dawned in education this morning. How are you feeling about it? How do you feel that Gavin has gone? How do you feel that Nadim has arrived? We want to hear from you at Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in, talk it out. So if you've woken up this morning, you haven't actually heard the news because perhaps you were caught late, perhaps, I don't know, you've stayed off social media and haven't caught the news. Why don't we get you up to speed, and we'll share a news special this morning for you.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News with Tom Hopkins-Burke.
This is Tom Hopkins-Burke with a Teachers Talk Radio News special. Gavin Williamson has lost his job as Secretary of State for Education as part of a wider government reshuffle. Williamson, who had served as Education Secretary since 2019, has been criticised for his handling of schools and exams during the pandemic. Williamson tweeted he was particularly proud of the transformational reforms in post-16 education, in further education colleges, skills agenda, apprenticeships and more. Boris Johnson said last week that Williamson had done a heroic job of dealing with very difficult circumstances. Reaction to Gavin Williamson's departure as Education Secretary has been overwhelmingly positive. Shadow Education Secretary Kate Green claimed that Williamson has failed children and young people, their parents and our hard-working education staff during the pandemic. Sam Friedman, former Department for Education Special Advisor under Michael Gove, said that Williamson was by some distance the worst Education Secretary in history. And a statement from the University and College Union representing further and higher education workers said that Williamson was a disastrous Secretary of State who caused deep and lasting damage. Gavin Williamson has been replaced as Secretary of State for Education by Nadim Zahawi. Zahawi, who has previously served as a junior minister in the Department for Education, is also a co-founder of a polling company, YouGov. As vaccines minister, Zahawi oversaw the approval of a single-dose vaccine for children aged between 12 and 15. Zahawi caused controversy last year by claiming falsely that poorer parents would prefer to pay a modest sum for free school meals. That was your Teachers Talk Radio News special with Tom Hopkins-Burke.
So how are you feeling about the news this morning? Text in, call in this morning. Do tell us, how do you feel that Gavin's gone? How do you feel that Nadim's out? We really want to hear from you. If you don't get opportunity to join the live show, you're going to get opportunity on our other shows on TT Radio later on today. Text in at TT Radio 21 or hashtag TT Radio. We really do want to get a sense of how our teachers and others in the teaching profession feel about the news today. Are there positives that Gavin Williamson brought in throughout your teaching career? How do you feel about it? What is your response to the news that Thomas shared in our news broadcast about Nadeem Sahawi coming in? What do we already know about Nadeem Sahawi? There was some information that was shared online last night in terms of, I think it was on Second Education. We'll get the source for you a little later on. And I'll link that source from my Twitter page. But what do we already know? So born in 1967, Nadeem Sahawi is 54 years old. So in terms of averages, that is 5 years older than the average starting age of education secretaries, which is 49 years old. So he's far from the oldest person to take the job on. That was Keith Joseph, who was 63. Zahawi is the first non-white education secretary in history. Now, is that going to have an impact on outcomes for young people? What do you think? As the first non-white education secretary, is that something of impact? Zahawi, as we know, was born in Iraq, but his family fled Saddam Hussein's regime, and Zahawi came to the UK when he was 9 years old and grew up in Sussex. Interestingly, he was educated initially at the comprehensive Holland Park School. And for those of you, our listeners here, who will follow Tom Rogers' account, that's the school that Tom has tweeted about recently, I believe. And after being educated initially at this comprehensive school, he did move to the private school, Ibstock Place, and was latterly educated at the King's College schools. So like the vast majority of past education secretaries, he was also privately educated. Now, how do our listeners feel about that aspect, that he was privately educated and representing maintained schools? Does that make a difference? Does it make a difference that our Secretary of State for Education was predominantly privately educated? Would it be more impactful that our Secretary of State was from a maintained education background? Does it make a difference? I'd love to hear from our listeners. Another thing that will come up perhaps, and would this have been made more of a matter of interest if the Secretary of State for Education were a woman? I'd love to know. But Nadeem Sahawi has three children. The average for other education secretaries is, interestingly, according to this article, 1.76. I'd be really keen to see what a child looks like if there's only 0.76 of them. But again, the most common number of children for an education secretary of state is zero. Interesting in terms of how they manage the work-life balance. And there's so much at the moment in terms of the cost of childcare and how the cost of childcare impacts on a parent's ability to sustain full-time work. So that's really interesting that Nadeem Sahawi has three children. Would more have been made of that were he a woman? I'd love to know your response to that. And Sobia has texted into the show saying that she doesn't think it makes a difference in terms of their education background, whether or not it's a state background or a private background, as long as the person who's taking on that role is seeking the expertise and advice from all stakeholders in education. It's a fantastic point. So we've got somebody calling in at the moment that would like to share something. So I'm going to invite them into the show. So I'm just adding you now. So I've sent out an invite. We look forward to hearing your point related to Nadeem Zahawi as coming in as Secretary of State. You're live on the show. Welcome this morning.
Thank you for having me, ma'am. And in past, also I have been here and I have shared something with you. So you are an incredible woman. You've given me a chance to speak here.
Thank you very much. Would you like to share something in regard to Nadeem Sahawi coming, becoming education secretary?
Yeah, ma'am. I have to share that, ma'am. I am an artist, and so I started creating one artwork. So for that, for the helping cancer patients, actually. So I request your followers that they can support my fundraising if they want. It's
thank you very much. That's great. Thank you. Okay, so we're going to move on. Thank you very much. So moving along, so let's go back to Nadeem Sahawi, and I'll just take that opportunity to just remind our callers that if you do want to have the opportunity to dis- to call in or text. We would love to hear from you. But if I can ask you to take the opportunity to ensure that calls into the show so that we can make the most of everyone's opportunity to talk with us are focused around the topic of the show, that'd be fantastic. So again, Zahawi, in terms of his, because there's been quite a bit of controversy around some of his views regarding 16 plus funding. If you look at his voting record, particularly, some of his voting has been around caps in terms of tuition fees and so on. But do take a moment to have a look at his voting record, because if you're ever interested in terms of how to vote in your local elections and so on, have a look at your local MP's voting record. But Zahawi studied chemical engineering at the University College London. And of course, he's the first education secretary to study that particular subject. But in terms of chemistry, what I found really interesting that the last person to take on the role of education secretary of state who studied chemistry was Margaret Thatcher. That was very interesting. In terms of Zahawi's career, let's go through a couple more key facts. He was an aide to Conservative politician Geoffrey Archer in the early 1990s. And as Tom has also shared with you, he co-founded the polling company YouGov in 2000. There are lots of other facts around Zahawi. It's so important that as teachers that we educate ourselves and we inform ourselves with the facts that are in front of us, as well as ensuring that we have the, you know, that we form our own opinions, because there are facts out there that we can find very, very easily. In terms of voting record, you can go to a website called They Work For You, which will reveal that Zahawi did consistently vote for greater autonomy for schools and is in support of the Academies programme. Jenny has texted in, thank you, Jenny, and has shared that the only positive that she can take of his appointment is that he was in charge of the vaccine rollout. And this may help with getting teens and vulnerable school staff vaccinated as soon as possible. And Jenny, if I may express a personal opinion, that was my initial response when I saw his name associated with the role before I had the opportunity to do some further research. That was my initial response. I think it is again important that we do some deeper research, but that was my own initial response. But really, really interesting. If any of you want some more trivial information about him, he's a keen horse rider. I'm not sure how that's going to equate with many of us, but he owns his own stables at his Warwickshire home. So if any of you are into equestrianism, he does have his own stables. But do inform yourselves, because information is power, as we know. But thank you very much for those of you that are texting in. But let us know, as you're able to gain some more information about Nadeem Zahawi, as you go into your schools, as your places of work, further education, universities and colleges today, and you do talk to your colleagues, start to form your own opinions. Do listen to your unions. Do listen to other people around you, but be careful to form your own opinions and base those on the facts that you have available to you. At Teachers Talk Radio, we work very, very hard to base to find out facts for you, to speak to people, to find out lots and lots of information on your behalf. So do keep in touch with Teachers Talk Radio. And for now, what we're going to do is we're going to hear from our sponsors.
Creative Resources, made for teachers by teachers. At Creative Resources, we've been rethinking what a classroom can be. We've created a huge range of more than 2,500 original and exciting resources that span across more than 15 different subject areas. Whether you're looking for primary or secondary level resources, careers options, PSHE, arts or humanities, Creative Resources have the resources for you.
We offer full curriculum packages and unique challenging escape rooms themed on topics such as Shakespeare, Tudors and fractions. We have quizzes, task cards, Tarsia puzzles and lots more. Better still, more than 100 resources can be accessed for free. Just visit our website www.cre8tiveresources.com. You can get 10% off any order you make on our website by using the discount code TT Radio. Creative resources made for teachers by teachers. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful, and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers, delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands like Faber-Castell and Stabilo.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
It feels really great to be supporting a family business that's run by real teachers. I can't help feeling like they just know what I'm going to enjoy using stationery-wise better than I do myself.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRADIO when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. Teacherslovestationery.club.
Okay, so I'm absolutely delighted this morning that we are about to welcome Megan Mansworth. Megan is a teaching fellow at Aston University and previously was a teacher and leader of English. She is the author of Teach to the Top, Aiming High for Every Learner, due to be released this week on Friday. I'm just going to encourage Megan to call in. She's had a wee bit of technological difficulties this morning. She is calling in to the live studio. So we're just going to give Megan a couple of moments to get herself sorted, but we are absolutely thrilled that she's here. Whilst we are welcoming Megan, she's here now. Megan, are you there?
Oh, hello. Yes, I am. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, I can hear you perfectly. There's a little bit of feedback on my voice.
Oh, okay. I can use a different device, maybe.
No, what I'll do is I'm going to ask you a question, if you can mute when I'm. That's right. If you mute when you're not speaking, that would be perfect. Thanks so much, Tom, and thanks, Sobia, as well. There, that's perfect. Thank you so much. Tom and Sobia know exactly how to fix these things. Thank you. That's absolutely brilliant. So what I would like our listeners to do this morning, if they can please send in their questions, because we've already had so much interaction on Twitter with our listeners telling us how they teach to the top. It would be fantastic if this morning, if they can send in, you know, call in with their questions, text in with their questions. But we're really, really grateful to you this morning for joining us, especially so early. I've had the opportunity, thanks to John Cap, to have a sneak preview of your book. And as I said to Megan when I was messaging her earlier this week, I kept shouting at it, but in a really, really positive way, like I would shout at the telly. But I'm going to ask, and it's really hard for Megan because she's now muted. So she's either really upset or she's really happy. But she can tell us that in a minute because I'm going to mute myself. But I'm going to ask Megan to start off by answering my first question, which is, what is teaching to the top? And that might involve probably telling us what it isn't. Thanks, Megan.
Thanks, Lizzie. Hope you can hear me okay now. I think sometimes when talking about what teaching to the top is, it's quite helpful to start with what it isn't. So I think when you hear the word, the phrase, I think not always, but sometimes it's associated with most able students or stretching a select group of students. But it's really not about that, or at least not in the way that I've envisioned it and researched and spoken about it in this book. So it's more about in the way it's typically conceived, it's usually about pitching learning at the top end of a group and then scaffolding and supporting students to meet that. And I think that's something that a lot of the teachers who've commented on this on Twitter, they've talked about and shared their strategies for that. So I certainly cover that type of teaching to the top in the book, and I explore that and how teachers can do that, and I explore some of the research behind why that's effective as well. So I do that, but I also try to think about teaching to the top in a slightly broader sense as well. So I try to think about how we can teach to the top as well by not only pitching to the top end of a particular group in terms of grades, but actually reaching beyond that and thinking about our subject as a broader discipline. So looking to higher level knowledge beyond our classroom, so looking to university level knowledge and incorporating really challenging and higher level knowledge within learning really as well. So it's, I suppose that's the way I'd summarize it. And really it's about challenge as well, and not just challenging a select group, but how we can challenge every student through these strategies really.
Okay. Do you think there are dangers, perhaps, dangers is probably a really extreme word, but do you think there are downsides of teachers not teaching to the top?
Massively, really. I think the thing is, at any point when we're not trying at least to teach to the top and trying to look to the furthest point that we think that a class or an individual as well can reach, I think the issue with that is that we're always going to be necessarily limiting learning. So certainly I think that's one of the dangers, that actually that can be actively quite limiting if we're not looking to the furthest point that we believe a child or a learner can get to. But also there's a danger too with students' data limiting them as well. And so if we don't try to look beyond perhaps what a child's received in a year six SATs exam when they're in secondary school, and we therefore teach them to a lower level because of what we perceive their pre-existing achievement to be, for instance, that can be another danger as well. So I think there's a huge range of dangers and difficulties that I explore in the book. Another one, for instance, is that sometimes when we try to teach students in a simple way and we simplify concepts, but we do it too much and we perhaps oversimplify, then sometimes we can embed ways of doing things that aren't necessarily the most effective, when actually by spending the time teaching the more complicated version or the more difficult knowledge from the start, then we then lay the groundwork for their future success as well. So that's just a couple of examples. There's a lot of different examples I go through in the book of that, and different research as well. But certainly I think that just as it's incredibly beneficial to teach to the top, it's also limiting, and it's also potentially dangerous in terms of embedding underachievement too, not to as well. So yeah, definitely.
You talk a lot about that sense of self-fulfilling prophecy. And we'll come back to that, because you describe it as, I know we've talked about it before, this sort of Pygmalion theory. And we will come back to that, because I want to dig a bit deeper into that. But one of the things I love about your book is your constant reference to sort of the research-informed benefits. Can you sort of go into that bit more deeply now in terms of the research-informed benefits of teaching to the top?
Sorry, Lizzie, it just broke up for a moment there. I think you're asking about the research-informed benefits of...
Yeah, that's correct. Thank you.
So, because I've split it into different sections where I explore different types of research relating to teaching to the top, because what I found really is that sometimes it's one of those things that I know that I certainly, when I was a student teacher, I heard the phrase, and I'd heard it you know, bandied around in schools, and other people had said it in front of me. And I know it's something I've heard given as a target to student teachers, but I think that sometimes some of us might feel, you know, what does that actually mean? What does it mean in practice? What does it mean in terms of the research? So because it is quite a broad phrase, teaching to the top, it's not specifically something that's, you know, usually researched in those terms. So what I've tried to do instead is split up teaching to the top into, as a, you know, as a broader concept, I've tried to split it up into more specific areas. So for example, I've looked at, for instance, one of my chapters is about thinking hard and challenging students conceptually. So in that chapter, for instance, I've used research from Robert Coe, where around the benefits of students having opportunities to think hard, for instance, and I've other research on conceptual challenge. Or in another chapter, for example, I've looked at research behind some of the potential issues with differentiation when it's differentiation by task, and differentiating by task can be one way that sometimes we don't teach the top, for instance. So there's lots of research that I cover in the book as well, towards around high expectations, around student achievement being more level in societies where expectations are more even. Sometimes some of the research I've covered as well is around the process of scaffolding students to reach that top point too. So it's really a broad range, and I've tried to sort of split it into those categorizations, because I think that's perhaps one of the issues with the term, that it can sometimes feel like a bit of an empty phrase. So unpicking it is quite helpful, and thinking about different aspects of research that actually support it as a broader idea.
I think it's huge, because research informed is just bandied about at the moment, and I think it's in danger of becoming a little bit trendy. Well, it's very trendy, but I think it's in danger of becoming a phrase that's just bolted on without the credence that it needs in terms of actual research. And the best bit about your, well, not the best bit actually, but one of the best bits about your book is that it reads in many ways like an evidence-informed journal that you would get, but it's so accessible. And so many of the names that I'm used to, that we read or we associate with, like I recognize so many of the names, and Bjork and the Bjork and Bjork, and so many of the names, like, I've heard of those names, and now I can actually associate it with a tangible strategy. And it just felt familiar but accessible, and I'm thankful to you for that, so thank you.
Oh, great. Well, that's really, really good to hear. Yeah, that's really what I was trying to do, and that made it quite challenging at times to write, because it's about having that balance between practical strategies, but I did want it to be you know, really completely research informed, really, in the ideas that I was sharing. So it is intended to be like that, and to provide a bit of a more accessible way into different educational research around this, really. So I'm really glad that you found.
Definitely. Okay. So there's a couple of quotes that I absolutely love and I like to trot out a lot. One of my favorites is Sam Strickland's, "You promote what you permit, you permit what you promote. And I've got another of my new favorite quotes is from your book. "You can't provide what your students deserve if you do not know your stuff." I loved that quote, but I think it's going to prove quite controversial. How vital is subject knowledge when you're teaching to the top? Because so many of us, I've taught outside my subject area many, many times, because I'm trained as a French and German teacher, but I have taught drama, English. I've taught, for my sins, I taught history, and it was absolutely spot on. How vital is that subject knowledge? And can I just interrupt by saying that we've got a text in from Tom, which says, "How can Megan become the next schools minister?" It's not been announced yet, Megan. You can still put your hand there. How vital is that subject knowledge when you're teaching to the top?
Yeah, that's a really good point about that potentially being a bit controversial. And I think so too, really. And I think that one of the things to emphasize about that, when I say that subject knowledge is absolutely vital, you know, what I'm absolutely not saying is that you need to you know, be the world expert in your subject and have three doctorates in it to be able to teach it well. Really, the point is that it's about your attitude to subject knowledge, I think. So if you value it and see it as important, then even if it is a subject that you're not so familiar with, you will focus on developing your knowledge base and really starting at that point. And if you're on that continual journey of developing subject knowledge, then it gives you what you need, really, to provide what your students deserve. So I suppose that's my point, really, that the subject knowledge itself is important, but it's not about your starting point necessarily. So, you know, if you're an RE teacher and you're teaching history for the first time, or French teacher teaching, you know, geography, doesn't mean that you can't teach it, but I think it does mean that it will be more challenging, because you've got to approach it with that, you know, with that mindset, really, of that subject knowledge. But, you know, at the same time, increasing subject knowledge and CPD around subject knowledge can be really beneficial for teachers' motivation and their interest in their own subject, which can have knock-on positive effects too. So I think essentially developing, expanding subject knowledge is something that is so empowering for teachers. And, you know, it's something that we can all benefit from developing in different ways, really. So I think, you know, the research as well, another reason it's controversial is because the research has differed, and some studies have found subject knowledge to be more effective than others. But another issue with that is that a lot of that research relies on self-reported subject knowledge. So it really relies a lot of the time on, you know, the confidence of teachers themselves, rather than any objective study of their subject knowledge as well. So I try and unpick that and demonstrate that in the book, and explore the ways in which it is so, so vital and so beneficial, really.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I just want to go. I'm going to go to our listeners quickly, and then I want to come back to the matter of the research. Kate says, 100% agree. You then pass on your passion for the subject too. Kate's preempted my next question, which is fantastic. And TSCW says, it's very true. Sometimes I do find, when teaching a new subject, I go so deep into learning my subject that I find my subject knowledge is good too. Though, is don't forget things, is so used to teaching it. If that makes sense, that's absolutely true. You almost go into autopilot. A solid and deep knowledge base is so important. Jenny asks a question. Brilliant. Would you say teaching to the top is suitable for primary schools too? Megan, what do you think?
Yeah, I definitely think it is. You know, I think that as teachers, we use our, of course, we'll use our professional judgment in different circumstances. So the level to which you go with teaching to the top will differ, you know, depending on the level that you're teaching at. But I think that with a primary school, for instance, it might not necessarily always look like taking ideas from academic knowledge like it might do at A level, but instead looking, you know, beyond what we might typically expect a primary school child to be able to do, and thinking beyond that point, really. So using the research in the same way. So I definitely think it is. And I also think, in terms of developing subject knowledge as well, that's just as applicable for primary schools as secondary schools, because of course primary school teachers have to teach multiple subjects. And in a way, that I suppose primary school teachers, even more than secondary school teachers, many of them are already used to that sort of continual state of knowledge development, due to the breadth of what they have to teach. So certainly really applicable to both. Some aspects of it are, for instance, that, you know, when I speak about differentiation and how that can prevent teaching to the top, or also, you know, teaching to the top and not the test. Some of those chapters are particularly relevant, I think, to primary school. But definitely, I think the concepts, I've tried to take research from both primary and secondary levels. So I am secondary trained, but having worked in some primary schools in one of my previous roles, and also taken a range of research from primary schools, I've tried to really, like, think about teaching to the top as a concept that is quite overarching, really, and we can use all stages.
Yeah. Going back to the research that you talked in terms of how vital subject knowledge is in teaching to the top, you reference in your book Co et al. In 2014's research in terms of what makes great teaching. And they draw out the fact that content knowledge and quality of instruction are two of the key elements that make that are vital in terms of what makes great teaching, which I thought was particularly current in terms of the early career framework and in terms of the importance around instruction, and particularly interesting with your book around the content knowledge. And also what I found really interesting was around your reference to the subject audits that we do at PGCE, because I do remember doing my subject audit. It was 20 years ago, but I do remember doing those subject audits, and how important it is for that self-perception of knowledge, but we just stop doing it as we go through our careers.
Yeah, definitely. It's it's a shame, really. And I think that it's a really, really valuable process. And I think that it could be something that definitely could be more explicitly embedded in within a lot of schools. It is in some already, and some schools are making brilliant strides towards more subject-specific CPD. So that's really, really encouraging. I think in a lot of settings, it could be more embedded, that subject-specific CPD. So I've tried to provide different examples of that in the book as well. But definitely that process of self-reflection, of auditing our own subject knowledge, and then examining the areas that we can develop. But I think one of the pieces of research I drawn in the book by Ellis is that a lot of the time, subject knowledge has been conceived of as this sort of inert and fixed entity, as opposed to pedagogical knowledge, which is seen as something that can be developed and improved. And so we have the danger of falling into a trap of seeing subject knowledge as something we have well or we don't have, and an area that we can teach well or we're not as happy with. But of course, it needs to be that continual process of development, which really has, I think it has benefits for teachers' enjoyment of their job as well, if they have the time and the space to engage in that, as well as that. But definitely what you say about the research around Co's research, quality of instruction and content knowledge, I think that's so important. And at the same time, even quality of instruction a lot of the time is partly down to content knowledge too, and without that, it's difficult for us to really provide anything that our students need, I think. So I do think it's crucial.
I would be interested to know how many teachers have been sent on, or not been sent on, that sounds awful, very draconian, how many teachers have been on CPD or requested to go on CPD related to their subject knowledge without it seeming as something punitive. I mean, I requested to do CPD around languages because I wanted to teach a third language, but it was self-funded and self-motivated. So I took a Spanish GCSE. But I can't think of any other examples that I know of. And I know of other colleagues who have learned an additional language. But I've never really thought about it in terms of CPD being pedagogical, because we think of subject knowledge as fixed. But I'd love to know if there are any other listeners who have in their subject area developed their subject knowledge in a similar way. Or it's been, encouraged in their school.
Yeah, I'd be really interested to hear that too, because I think you're right. I think it's much more frequent that, we have pedagogical CPD. And I think that's a really good point about, it not seeming punitive or someone saying that you haven't got great subject knowledge, because I think that's an entirely different thing, really, to what I'm talking about. Because I suppose what I'm suggesting in the book and in the examples I give of CPD that schools can engage in, it really has to be about every teacher, from leaders to NQTs, engaging in that process of reflection, having those opportunities to develop subject knowledge. So different strategies for that I go into in the book as well. But I definitely agree. So especially as well, we can look at ways of developing subject knowledge collaboratively, and those opportunities within departments or in primary schools between staff as well. And then that can really help avoid that. And in fact, I think one of the great things about subject knowledge is that actually, an NQT probably, won't have the strongest, usually pedagogical knowledge compared to perhaps a much more experienced teacher. But they may have subject knowledge that is actually stronger than another member of the department in a particular area. And so we can also engage in this sharing and collaborative sharing of expertise as well, which I discuss in the book too. So it can be quite empowering, because we've all got things we can learn more. We've all got areas we can develop further when it comes to subject knowledge. And it's also something that's, like I say, really empowering and enthusing often for teachers to have the opportunity too. So definitely I'd be interested to hear of other people's experiences about that.
Yeah, that's a nice segue into this idea of a communal endeavour that you describe, and in the idea of teacher expertise led CPD. And I like to think that PT Radio is a great example of this, where we engage that teacher expertise led CPD. Can you explain how teachers might be able to engage in this on a more localised level? So in terms of, developing our subject knowledge on, impacting our own levels of enthusiasm, which will ultimately lead to teacher retention.
Yeah, definitely. So I think definitely in terms of individual subject knowledge then, I'll talk about individual subject knowledge and also kind of that communal collaborative subject knowledge development as well. So individually, it might involve things like reading academic journal articles on the topic. So kind of going beyond what you necessarily would expect to just look at on, curriculum. So not just looking at the textbook, but looking at perhaps a higher level article on that, reading things like academic literature, textbooks. But definitely, it doesn't have to be things like that. It can be things like asking in teacher communities on Twitter for advice. And I know that, for instance, there's so many professional development and subject communities on Twitter, such as Team English for English, where teachers really come together to share their expertise and ideas as well. If we think about more communal opportunities for subject knowledge development, then we could also think about things like, as a department, reading that's linked to subject knowledge, not just pedagogy, and then sharing, learning, discussing that, cascading that to the group. Can be things like subscribing to subject journals and then using articles as a basis for discussion, or also engaging in, sometimes you can have specialist expert input in subject knowledge, but also departments then engaging in that in a peer way as well. So with collaboration and peer support combined with that too. There's also, I think, in terms of what I talk about with personal auditing of subject knowledge, you can also do that as a group as well, again, in a collaborative way. So you can be asking collective questions. So, who are the experts on this topic in our team, department, our school? Who knows this particular topic really well? Who knows this one really well? And encouraging staff to have the opportunity to share that with others as well, and to carve out time. I know it's difficult in schools, but to use part of the CPD calendar to carve out time for that as well. So I think really a shared process of reflection, development, and can really help to emphasize that idea that it is something that's always capable of development and can massively enrich teaching and learning as well.
We've had lots of interaction here, particularly Sobia saying, teaching and learning should be the main focus in schools. Unfortunately, not all schools get that. In terms of how other listeners are developing that, sense of communal endeavour or working independently, networking with other subject specialists across schools usually helps. It can be helpful to be part of a multi-academy trust. In terms of business studies, keeping up to date with industry practice as well as what's happening in terms of pedagogy can be incredibly helpful. I think sometimes we can be really myopic as teachers and we can forget that something happens outside our institutions, and actually looking outside at the wider world can be incredibly motivational. And just stepping outside of the institution of education is so motivational. And I found that LinkedIn is really helpful in terms of that. And I know that some educators find LinkedIn really, really helpful. I certainly have, in terms of just understanding what's going on out there. But I found it really, really great, particularly in terms of well-being, because you can connect with clinical psychologists, you can connect with people within positive psychology, well-being, trauma-informed support. So as in terms of social media, LinkedIn is fantastic for supporting my professional development. But other listeners, how do you develop your own professional development, collaboratively or independently? Please do text in, or if you want to go live, call in as well.
What we're going to do now is we're going to take a short break to hear from our sponsors, give Megan the opportunity to take a breath. And after that, we are going to come back because we've still got some more questions for Megan about teaching to the top. But do take this opportunity to have a breath, have a stretch, and think of some more questions for us, please do. But huge thanks to Megan for joining us this morning on TT Radio.
Need support with your phonics teaching? Did you know Oxford University Press now has 3 DfE validated programmes to help you? Read Write Ink Phonics, Floppy's Phonics, and the brand new Essential Letters and Sounds. Essential Letters and Sounds will get all your children reading well, quickly, using phonics books you may already have in your classroom. Developed by the Knowledge Schools Trust English Hub, it's affordable, easy to use, and makes teaching phonics with letters and sounds more effective. Whatever your school's phonics needs, Oxford has the solution. To find out more and receive support from your expert local educational consultant, visit oxfordprimary.com/phonics. Every teacher loves stationery, right? Imagine getting a selection of fun, beautiful, and unique stationery items designed and selected especially for teachers, delivered through your door every month. You need to check out teacherslovestationery.club.
I'm always so excited when the box arrives. It's such a treat.
My Teachers Love Stationery Club box is just a little treat to myself every month.
It's always full of delightful and surprising items, including some really good quality stationery brands like Faber-Castell and Stabilo.
And because you never know what you're going to get, it makes it even more fun and special when you get it.
It feels really great to be supporting a family business that's run by real teachers. I can't help feeling like they just know what I'm going to enjoy using stationery-wise better than I do myself.
Visit teacherslovestationery.club and enter the code TTRadio when you buy your first stationery box to save £2 today. teacherslovestationery.club.
Okay, welcome back. Before we do welcome back Megan, we're going to take a moment to reflect on this new day in education. And we are in terms of saying goodbye to Gavin. And we're going to hear on TT Radio news special, because for some of you, you may not have had opportunity to catch up with the news in your local area. And we're going to hear our TT Radio news special in our area.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News with Tom Hopkins-Burke.
This is Tom Hopkins-Burke with a Teachers Talk Radio News special. Gavin Williamson has lost his job as Secretary of State for Education as part of a wider government reshuffle. Williamson, who had served as Education Secretary since 2019, has been criticised for his handling of schools and exams during the pandemic. Williamson tweeted he was particularly proud of the transformational reforms in post-16 education, in further education colleges, skills agenda, apprenticeships and more. Boris Johnson said last week that Williamson had done a heroic job of dealing with very difficult circumstances. Reaction to Gavin Williamson's departure as Education Secretary has been overwhelmingly positive. Shadow Education Secretary Kate Green claimed that Williamson has failed children and young people, their parents and our hard-working education staff during the pandemic. Sam Friedman, former Department for Education Special Advisor under Michael Gove, said that Williamson was by some distance the worst Education Secretary in history. And a statement from a university and college union representing further and higher education workers said that Williamson was a disastrous Secretary of State who caused deep and lasting damage. Gavin Williamson has been replaced as Secretary of State for Education by Nadeem Zahawi. Zahawi, who has previously served as a junior minister in the Department for Education, is also a co-founder of a polling company, YouGov. As vaccines minister, Zahawi oversaw the approval of a single-dose vaccine for children aged between 12 and 15. Zahawi caused controversy last year by claiming falsely that poorer parents would prefer to pay a modest sum for free school meals. That was your Teachers Talk Radio news special with Tom Hopkins-Burke.
Huge thanks to Tom for our new special today. You are joining us back on Teachers Talk Radio. This is The Breakfast Show. It is Thursday, the 16th of September, and we are joined in the studio by Megan Mansworth. We've been talking today about teaching to the top. Huge thanks to everybody who has been texting in and calling in with their questions today. We've been covering everything today around teaching to the top in terms of our subject knowledge as educators and teacher expertise-led CPD. So in terms of our next questions for Megan, we're going to be covering everything from planning a curriculum of challenge, talking about differentiation. And a quote that I absolutely loved from Megan's book is, "We aim above the mark to hit the mark," from Ralph Waldo Emerson. We'll come on to that shortly. So I don't even know where to start. I've got so many questions. But the first question I'm going to have for Megan is that we're going to move on now to the ideology of challenge, Megan. So talk to us about how teachers and leaders can embed an ideology of challenge into our curriculum. Now, I always enjoy a Mary Myatt reference. We are huge Mary Myatt fans at TT Radio. She's been a guest on TT Radio. In particular here, the deep dive into quality, not quantity, of curriculum content. And breadth, you know, in terms of breadth and depth of curriculum. Can you talk to us more about what an ideology of challenge is and how we could embed that into a curriculum in our schools?
Yeah, so what I'm talking about here is really the mindset that we take to what we envision our students as being able to understand and capable of, and what knowledge we see them as deserving knowing and having access to. So I do quote Mary Myatt in this chapter because, like you say, it's about her comments are really helpful thinking about quality as a way of thinking about challenge, not necessarily quantity. So when I'm talking about a challenging curriculum, I'm definitely not suggesting we need to cram in every aspect of an undergraduate education at all within the curriculum. And I also say in the chapter that, you know, there's already some like fantastic books, like you say, from Mary Myatt, Kat Howard and Claire Hill on curriculum planning. So I talk specifically not about curriculum planning in general, but about this ideology and mindset of challenge and how we can work to embed that in the curriculum. So really, it's about thinking carefully about, is each aspect of content within the curriculum building towards this goal of being able to make everything challenging and intellectually stimulating enough that our students are experiencing knowledge and learning at the top level of which they're capable, really. So we can ask ourselves key questions to help with that. So we can ask, is the lesson content and the curriculum content demanding, but is it at the same time accessible? So coming together to talk about and discuss and decide on levels of learning that are both demanding but also are made accessible. So often that's about pitching really high but making it accessible with, for instance, really clear explanation, scaffolding, models or support in different ways as well, which I talk about in a bit more detail in the book too. And also thinking as well about, you know, which key disciplinary concepts we begin to build early on, which then develop and take us to that point. So another thing to think about too is that challenge in terms of the curriculum doesn't necessarily have to mean quantity of content, as Mary Myatt says, but also thinking about how actually challenge can come in the way students apply their learning as well. And so, for instance, challenge doesn't have to just come in a list of high-level knowledge. It can also come in the way students are expected to apply their learning. So by giving them really high-level examples, for instance, really high-level models, and then therefore encouraging them to and enabling them to write responses at that level, for instance, and engaging in processes of redrafting and developing of key pieces of work, for instance, to get to that top point. So it certainly can encompass, you know, the what of the curriculum in terms of the knowledge and concepts within it, but also thinking about the level at which things are applied to. So in terms of embedding that as, you know, as an ideology of challenge in the curriculum and embedding that mindset, So I talk quite a bit about that process of discussing and coming together as a department to and a school to identify those concepts too. But I also talk about as well, I use some research from Hattie on collective teacher efficacy, where Hattie talks about this concept of collective teacher efficacy, which basically means teachers, the way teachers believe that what they do will make a difference to student outcomes. So the idea that students can achieve well and that teachers believe they can make a difference. And I talk about that research and how we can work to foster that mindset around challenge in schools. So in order to do that, it's about really, again, collaboration and that sense of being a team where we set high expectations as a whole school or department by having collaborative CPD and discussions around which elements of our curriculum could be made more challenging, where could we bring in higher level knowledge, who in our department is really good at teaching a particular subject in a challenging way, you know, what are the most challenging concepts we teach at the moment, and what concepts might our students really benefit from being introduced to name but a few. So I give lots of examples in the book of questions we can ask to help increase our sense of collective teacher efficacy around challenge, because really, if we believe that we have the, you know, the capacity to make a difference through providing that challenging learning, then that's really, really powerful as well. So yeah, those are some of the ideas that I talk about.
Yeah, I particularly liked the section around Hattie and collective teacher efficacy, because I think there's a real movement towards a desire for that. And I think it's going to be increasingly difficult for people to push against that. I think there is a fear in some schools for staff. And I've had this conversation with Bex Waker, who runs the Page to Practice podcast, that she's experienced a pushback against that desire to be part of a collective teacher efficacy movement, so to speak, and that fear of almost snobbery towards it. Oh, why are you doing that? That sort of sensation in the staff room when she's wanting to engage in CPD and so on. But I think there's increasingly a movement away from that. I'm going to be optimistic and hope that there is. So I think there's so much more enthusiasm on a general scale. I'd like to know from listeners, although it will be very biased, because anyone who's here from 7 a.m. listening to our conversation is definitely going to be pro that teacher efficacy movement. But I really do hope that our listeners are increasingly feeling a sense of optimism towards it. And there are questions and strategies in your book around how we can move that forward. Would you have anything to say or anything to share with our listeners that might be experiencing a pushback against that?
Yeah, so I mean, in terms of what I said previously about reflection in terms of subject knowledge, I think that process of reflection as a group can be really powerful in increasing collective teacher efficacy as well. Because if we're reflecting on you know, what's going well in terms of challenge, and where challenging concepts have enriched students' learning, or perhaps sharing with each other what the consequences have been. So even just sharing a student's piece of work, for instance, or having that built in time for reflection on how the challenging aspects of the curriculum are being embedded, then that can be really powerful because people are seeing the positive consequences of it. So there's some really interesting more recent research as well from Donoghue, Hattie and Eales, and they say that the key to building collective teacher efficacy is evidence of impact. So we have to ensure that teachers see the results of a method if they're really going to see how useful it is. So they also cite a concept from a researcher called Bandura of reciprocal causality, which basically means that the more collective teacher efficacy we experience, the more likely we are to experience it in the future. So in terms of what it means for challenge, you know, it means that really it's self-renewing. So what, not only do we need to embed that challenge and have that in the curriculum and work to increase and develop that, but we need to take the time to reflect on the positive consequences of it too. So that might take the form of discussing in meetings, reflecting on how particular concepts have been introduced, how that's gone, you know, which points students have really grappled with complex concepts and done well with them, and reflecting on our own areas for development and how that's gone as well. So that process of reflection, and I know that, you know, schools are very busy places and it's difficult to do in sometimes in practice, but actually this is a really research informed way of increasing collective teacher efficacy, which could then help to increase challenge as well. And also, I think sometimes it's tempting in schools to, we're so often given new initiatives, new ideas. It's such a busy environment with so much to do, but it is about really trying to build in that time to look for the good as well as the areas for improvement, because then we're going to see the positive consequences. So that can really help, I think, that positive mindset too.
I clearly forget that I'm not on Teams because you can't see me smiling and nodding furiously. I absolutely agree. And I think, you know, that's the way that we're going to reinforce it. That's the way that we're going to bring people on board, is by focusing on the positives. You know, we would do that with pupils. And we know that we feel better and we're more likely to do more of something that makes us feel good and motivates us to do more of. I have so many more questions and I'm aware of time. There's so much in here. This is fantastic. Sobia's got a question for you, one of our listeners. What advice would you give to smaller departments with non-specialists and one or two people only?
That's a really good question. And I do think that if you are a one or two person department, you have got more of a challenge in terms of that, those opportunities to learn from others in the department, and even just that sharing of practice that I discuss as well. So I think that, I mean, it's not something that can perhaps be done in a day or a week, but I certainly think joining collaborative local networks and of subject specialists. So I give some examples in the book of fostering subject knowledge on an individual level and developing that individually, and also in terms of the curriculum, ways you can do that too. But in a smaller department, it is more challenging not to have those people to bounce ideas off and to discuss things. So I would say things around taking advantage of the way we have things like Twitter now. We have that opportunity to connect with people. I think that there's really, you know, there's nothing more beneficial than reflection to practice, really. And that can take the form and should take the form of having that opportunity to discuss things too. So it's difficult, but I definitely think it's worth connecting, trying to connect with others in things like subject knowledge groups, Twitter communities, and any other opportunities you have, really, to kind of seek out those connections too. So I'd say, you know, it's definitely something where we should be looking to where we can kind of find those connections, because they are so beneficial, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the concerns is around non-specialists. In particular, I've been a line manager of maths for many years, and that's always a concern for me in terms of making sure, as a line manager, when I have to challenge challenge and support a line manager of a subject area where that's not my skill particularly. Whilst I don't have to have full subject knowledge, I do want to have an understanding of the subject. It's making sure that make sure I'm informed as well. Jennifer's texted in saying you can always leverage STEM ambassadors for subject knowledge, and making sure that, you know, there's curriculum hubs across the country. And don't forget teaching school hubs. The teaching school hub network is now live. So if you go to the teaching school hub websites, I know I'm biased because I know quite a bit about the teaching school hubs, but also curriculum hubs that have been around. You can get some information there as well. And the Research School Network, run by the Education Endowment Foundation as well. Huge thanks to Libby this morning, who's texted in saying she's enjoyed this listen to work on her way to work this morning, especially the conversation around how if you focus staff on showcasing the positive impact of the things you're talking through, it makes such a difference to them and their buy-in. Have a great day at work. Thank you. So we've got some more questions to move you on. I'm going to ask you about one of my favourite phrases that I just hadn't come across before. I have heard of Bjork and Bjork before because Kate Jones, one of our TT radio presenters, references Bjork and Bjork quite a bit, but I hadn't heard the phrase desirable difficulties before. Now, I have come across the concept of desirable difficulties myself quite a lot, having just finished my master's and having slogged through, I almost said statistics, which actually I should call it, but I've been studying statistics, which felt sadistic. But now actually I quite enjoy t-tests and factorial and overs. Tell us more what a desirable difficulty is, please, Megan.
Yeah, it's a really interesting piece of research, and it's been reinforced as well in other studies too. So Bjork and Bjork found that if we give students strategies to improve quickly, that might be tempting in the short term, but it can actually fail to help increase retention in the long term. So actually, it really kind of, sometimes it can be quite counterintuitive for us as teachers, but it can be good to find learning difficult within reason. So, you know, we can sometimes remember difficult concepts that we've had to really grapple with to understand. We'll remember those in the long term better than ones that we've kind of understood straight away. So I think this is quite a challenging concept for teachers, because we don't want to, you know, take this concept and think, oh, right, students should be struggling and feeling miserable and banging their head against a brick wall. But what it's about is creating those opportunities for challenge, and also, you know, balancing that with really high levels of encouragement as well to ensure students feel empowered as well, and appropriate levels of scaffolding, but not so much so that we take away any difficulty whatsoever, because then students just won't really remember what they've learned. So one thing I talk about in the book is I discuss what might be the difference between a scaffold and a shortcut. So if we, you know, if we're scaffolding students to learn and understand a difficult concept, that's brilliant. But if we're just providing a shortcut where they, you know, we're actually not giving them the process of learning about it, learning to do it, or learning about a difficult concept in more detail, then we're really perhaps preventing them from learning. So that, for instance, we might be better off taking the time to show a student lots of examples of how they can include evidence and quotations in their writing, and then giving them the opportunity to do that, rather than simply providing them with, you know, set sentence starters. So that's just an example from English or primary education as well. But that, for example, could actually, in the long term, they're not going to remember how to do it themselves than if they'd had a process of seeing lots of different examples, working through that as an activity, and having a level of independence. So it's about that balance and realizing, yeah, that sometimes struggling with a concept can be beneficial. So it's about those small levels of difficulty that we are building in terms of the way we're pitching lessons and designing learning, I think.
I just think it's an excellent way of explaining what we're looking for in terms of desirable difficulties, because I remember a piece of research that I was reading, and I apologise that I can't think of where this piece of research came from, but in terms of we're looking for 80% of, and I think it was in teaching walkthroughs, we're actually looking to pitch the lesson at 80%, because anything above 80% and it's essentially too easy, anything below 80% and it's too difficult for the pupil. I think it's in the research section of teaching walkthroughs, but we're looking around 80% for the pupil to achieve, which I found really interesting, because I would have thought 80% for an outcome, and actually perhaps the pupil, I've pitched it incorrectly. But, and in terms of a parent, if my child came home and achieved 80%, how would I respond to that? Because I know when I was a child, if I'd achieved 80%, my parents would have been cross. But actually, now I understand the research better, in terms of that assessment, will I respond better, or would I respond more appropriately when my children come home with results?
Yeah, I think it's a really good point, and it's a really interesting, that's a really interesting piece of research. Yeah, what we don't want to do is, you know, have everything be so easy that students are just doing it on autopilot, with, you know, not needing that cognitive engagement, and then potentially not remembering and not embedding. So there needs to be that balance, and definitely, it's about balancing for challenge and desirable difficulties, but also making it accessible as well. So, you know, using your scaffolding, using your pre-teaching or provision of key vocabulary or your multiple different explanations. So giving students the tools to understand, but also giving them those opportunities to grapple with difficult concepts too. So it is a balance, but I think it's really interesting because I think perhaps as teachers, we want to make everything as easy as possible for our students. And I'm not suggesting that that's a bad thing to make things accessible. But if we need to have that balanced with the high level concepts in order for them to experience that desirable difficulty sometimes as well.
So in terms of those desirable difficulties, on the other side of the coin, we want to be thinking about what effective scaffolding looks like and how we can simplify those complex concepts. You know, there's so much discussion around scaffolding, and for some teachers, they may have experienced training where scaffolding may look like a closed activity, or it may look like simple gap fill, or it could just be a piece of lined paper with the outline of a dinosaur. Can you elaborate on what effective scaffolding looks like when teaching to the top?
Yeah, so I think in my head, I find it quite helpful to go back to that, you know, actually the metaphor of scaffolding and actually thinking about what that is. And, you know, we think about scaffolding being something that, you know, supports a building when it's not able to be independent, rather than something which, you know, completely provides everything for students. So it's about that support towards their independence. But, you know, scaffolding doesn't have to just take the, like you say, some closed procedure or students having things made so simple. Instead, it can really be about that process as well. So it can be about the steps we take to prepare students for what they're going to do. So the modeling, taking students through things step by step, providing in, you know, a lot of subjects, things like academic phrasing or vocabulary before the activity is engaged with and spending some time on that. The way we explain things as well even can be scaffolding. So, you know, giving a couple of different explanations in different ways with different clear examples. And, you know, with some students, yeah, they will need those resources to support them. So, you know, if we're teaching a class with students of a wide range of attainment levels, some students will need some resources to support them. They might need sentence starters. They might need a structure that's provided for them. But I think making those resources quite open, so, you know, that's a starting point, but also students not necessarily having to feel constrained by it. So, yeah, like you say, not giving a student something that completely restricts them, but provide that scaffolding while still being quite open in terms of what they can do with it as well. So I would say it'd be, you know, far better if everyone's doing an essay-based activity, for instance, something as simple that most teachers already do, such as providing sentence starters. There's absolutely nothing wrong with that, as long as students are also given that opportunity to embed the more challenging aspects as well, I think. So, it's about balance, really, I think.
I think, and imagine the sense of accomplishment, achievement, and that sense of self that all of the pupils in that class would get, because we underestimate how much the pupils see and feel. I remember my son coming home when he was 7 and saying, we've got the hippos, the macaws, and the lions in our class. And we've already worked out that the macaws are the middle ability. I mean, he was 7. The hippos are the high ability and the lions are the low ability. And I said, this is a 7-year-old articulating the language of low ability. And I said, and he said, well, I know that I'm in this group and so-and-so is in this group and he's really upset because he thinks he should be in the hippos. And you're thinking, you know, the teacher thinks they've pulled the wool over their eyes by using, they haven't used cheetahs and sloths. But you think, you know, it's just so demotivating because they're grouped in these groups. And I know that there has to be a logistically feasible way of doing this. But it would motivate the pupils infinitely more if there was a way of them all accessing activities in that way, because the children are aware from such an early age what's happening in the classroom. I want to take you on to one of my other favourite quotes. I do love a quote, which I referenced at the start of this section, which is from Ralph Waldo Emerson. And again, this is going to be quite polarising, this debate, because you are very, very measured in this chapter. And I'll read the quote first, which is that we aim above the mark to hit the mark. And this is around teaching to the top, not teaching to the test. And it's about ensuring that we still keep doors open for children. So you do acknowledge how important having examinations at GCSE and at A-level are for children, because we know how important it is. And you absolutely acknowledge this, because we all understand how important it is for children to have the best qualifications they need to have in order to be able to go on and achieve success in later life. But also it's so important not to create a culture where we're teaching to the test. And we need to be creating that environment where we're teaching to the top. Talk to us more, please, about what you mean in terms of that powerful quote.
Yeah, so what I mean by that, and why I use that really, is just as a way of introducing this idea that actually it's not necessary for teaching to the top to always be about, you know, a grade focused discussion. So like you say, I absolutely acknowledge the importance of preparing our students for the exams that they have, and I definitely would never deny that, and you know, would always make sure that the students that I teach have had that exposure to their mock examinations before their exams. They know what's on the exam, they know the grade boundary, they know, not grade boundaries, the different bands and what they need to do to achieve each band, etc. So not denying that, but what I am saying is that sometimes we get stuck in this from, you know, too early a point really, and rather than showing students, for example, what an amazing essay looks like, or discussing what an incredibly persuasive speech looks like, for example. So just a couple of examples from my subject, but in other subjects too, we quite early on start saying, you know, this is what a grade 7 looks like, this is what a grade 8 looks like, and therefore perhaps limit learning to that exam rather than actually that being used as a form of challenge as well. What we can do in order to make sure that students have what they need for the exam, but also things aren't completely focused on that, we can ensure that those exam skills are encompassed in our teaching, but also teach above that point as well. So, you know, we can even aim beyond the level of the highest grade by incorporating advanced concepts and knowledge, such as from degree level study or other concepts that we've find, for instance, interesting and enthusing as well. So, I mean, it will obviously depend on as well what stage students are at too. But I'm talking about, for instance, you know, if you're writing a model answer for a year 8 class, it doesn't necessarily need to be written to show them, oh, this is this grade. And in many ways, that sort of takes away the beauty of our subject, if everything's just about the grade and the mark that they might get, rather than actually what makes this interesting, what makes it good. It's about really as well not shying away from using that university level knowledge, or even, you know, A-level knowledge with a year 9 class in a way that they can understand and incorporating that. And partly that's because as well, grades have often been found in various pieces of research to decrease student motivation, and that actually if we aim high only in a grade linked way, then that can actually be harmful to achievement and self-esteem. So teaching to the top is often give students the opportunity to feel empowered by higher level knowledge and concepts. But if it's linked only to grades, then they will start to, a bit in the way you said about your son earlier, they'll start to almost compare themselves and judge themselves against others within a class group quite early. So, you know, if we say in year 7, oh, this is what a grade whatever looks like, this is what this mark looks like, from a very early point, so when we're first showing the model answers, then that's going to be all they think about, rather than the actual content and the skills that are demonstrated. So it's much more helpful really to kind of not overemphasize that as well. So, I mean, this partly interlinks with that challenging curriculum as well, because if you have that challenging curriculum, then you're going to be able to do that, and you'll know that students are getting what they need from you in terms of they are going to be prepared for the exam, but they're not necessarily having everything linked to a grade as such.
You started to touch on this here, and I've come across this in psychology, but something that some of our listeners may not have heard of before, but it's something that actually we talk about all of the time, and it's the zone of proximal development. And you may see it on Twitter, talked about ZPD, but we talk about this all the time, but we don't necessarily call it ZPD. What is it, and how does it impact on our expectations for pupils?
So the ZPD is, the zone of proximal development is a concept that I imagine most of your listeners probably come across before if they've been teaching a while, or even if you're a student teacher, it's probably something that you'll be told about. And it can be a really helpful concept because it can mean really that idea of building on what students know and understand in order to help them reach the next point. So the zone of proximal development is this area that we see students as being able to kind of work in next, so that where they're able to reach. However, it has been suggested that actually the way that this is sometimes used in schools can be quite oversimplified and can actually lead us to not challenging students enough. So when we think about the ZPD, sometimes it's been suggested, therefore, that any information that you provide students with should be pitched only at a level just above, you know, where they currently are. But actually, that's really helpful when it comes to what we're expecting them to do in terms of the tasks that we give them. But when it comes to the knowledge and information and concepts that we're introducing to them, we shouldn't feel that we have to shy away from introducing really high level concepts that we wouldn't necessarily. We wouldn't be surprised to find on a university level course. So another really interesting piece of research that Smagorinsky did in 2018, so quite recently, was an analysis of what Vygotsky actually meant when he said that when we teach students, we need to plant basically we plant seeds that will emerge as fruits of learning tomorrow. And what he suggests, this researcher, is that actually tomorrow shouldn't necessarily be interpreted literally. So we can sometimes, you know, plant these seeds of learning that we'll pick up again and build on as we kind of go through students' learning and as they progress through a curriculum. But we don't have to necessarily just pitch everything we tell them at a level exactly just above where they currently are. So again, it's about balance. But if you think about when you learn to talk, for instance, you would have come across as a, you know, small children, come across so many words that they can't understand yet. And it's, we don't necessarily, when we think about that form of learning, we don't necessarily think, oh, okay, well, we should only ever use words that they, you know, they are only just above their current level. In fact, if we use a broader and richer variety, that's ultimately better for their vocabulary development. So again, it is about balance. So, and that's really the thing about this book. For a presentation I did recently at Research Ed, I made a word cloud of the whole book. And one of the most, just out of interest really for myself, I deciding what to talk about. But one of the words that came up the most was might. So many of the things I suggest are, you know, they require reflection and application to your own context. But and it is about thinking about different ways this might work. But yeah, arguably that concept of the ZPD can make us shy away from higher level knowledge. And as long as we're not, you know, only, like you say, it's about the amount, and that 80% idea you talked about, that research is really interesting. So yeah, it's about balance, but it's not necessarily something that should stop us from introducing higher level concepts.
Amazing. Okay. The 80% comes from Rosenshine and is referenced in teaching walkthroughs, I've remembered. Yeah. So I'm I'm glad. I think most teachers will have come across, certainly our listeners will have come across Rose and Shine. I've got so much to absorb and process. And I've read the book, so I'm still absorbing so much. I'm conscious of time, and there's two big things I still want to talk about. One is differentiation, and the other is around the emotional support we offer our pupils. I can't choose between both of them. So I'm going to ask you to just talk to us a little bit about teaching to the top and differentiation. I've spent most of my career talking with teachers and training teachers around differentiation. And this is something that I'm incredibly passionate about because I've seen it done so incredibly well. But I've also seen examples of where it's been done in a way that teachers desperately need support in how to differentiate in a way that aids progress. So can you please share with listeners how you can effectively differentiate while still teaching to the top?
Definitely, yeah. So what I call this chapter in the book is the dangers of differentiation, because I do believe that differentiation, if it's not done in a research informed way, can be actively quite harmful to progress. So what I talk about as being harmful, and I know it's something that a lot of teachers share my views on, and also it's supported by a wealth of research, is differentiation by expectation as being really harmful, and linked to that, differentiation by task. So that's really your kind of, thankfully going out of fashion, but I've always hated it, that kind of almost and some idea, or splitting students into different boxes within the group and saying, if you're at a grade 4, you should be doing this task. If you're at a grade 5, you should be doing this. Grade 6, do this. And I think that it's usually incredibly harmful and unhelpful, because of course a student that usually places themselves in a grade 4 box, a student who's had on their report that their grade is lower than their friend or their classmate, is much more likely then to continue placing themselves in that box, even if we don't tell them to only aim for that grade. It's a way of suggesting that a class is split into categories and that we don't have the same expectations of everyone. And I think that if we actually think about what it would be like if it was like that for us at university level or in our own studies, it's kind of easier to see how that could be really harmful, and lead to this embedded sense of not being able to do the same things. So really, differentiation has to be, for it to be research informed and for it to be effective, it's more about really providing students with the tools to close that gap. So when we differentiate by task or expectation, we open the gap, we make it wider, so we actually embed differences in. Whereas when we differentiate by scaffolding, by support, by giving students the tools, then we really give them the opportunity then to develop and to do the same task as everyone else. And I'm not suggesting that they'll necessarily always reach the same outcome, and that's inevitable. However, if we just give them an easy task because we think that they'll be able to do that, and like you said earlier, I think, get them to draw a picture without having a go at the task that we're giving the rest of the class, then that can be really, really harmful, and actually embed that that perceived difference in ability as well. So I think that essentially it's about not placing limits on learning. So that idea that, a few years ago, it was quite common for people to want differentiation to be really explicit. So I think Ofsted at the time, for instance, about 10 years ago or so, would have been quite happy to see lots of different coloured worksheets with different tasks for different students. And that was something that some people were encouraged to do on their teacher training courses and that sort of thing. But now I think, people are thankfully really waking up to the fact that that's actually often really unhelpful, and differentiation should more be about actually trying to limit those differences. So, not everyone's going to achieve the same level, but helping to close that gap where we can, and helping to support students to reach that higher level. So I think really it's about avoiding differentiating by task wherever possible, and thinking about differentiation in as a form of supporting students, really. And I don't know if maybe even the word differentiation needs examining, and we eventually might move away from it, because there is that difference kind of embedded in it, isn't it? Which sometimes I think can lead to an misunderstanding that, you know, we need to make learning different for every child rather than support them to have the tools to achieve, really.
I'm sorry, I'm just typing everything down that you say. We could just buy your book, which is out tomorrow, rather than me typing everything down. Megan, thank you. I mean, one of the things that would be great to kind of phase out is the sort of well-known worksheets. I won't say the name of them, but Becky on a Sunday is associated with them. And for those, if you know, you know. And they have a different number of stars on them associated with the difficulty rate. And, you know, it'd be great if we could phase those out in terms of the automaticity around how they might be given out, or even if children are asked to self-select which ones they give out, as can happen. You know, there are situations whereby that can be the time can mean that that's the only option we have. But in terms of planning for challenge, if we plan to make learning different for every child in terms of the strategies that you've described, that's the ideology that we want to be embedding into our curriculum. Now, we are out of time, but I just want to squeeze in very cheekily, so long as I'm out in time for Tom to do his next show. The last area for our discussion is around the emotional support we offer our pupils and around building this sort of growth mindset and building encouragement and championing of our students into our interactions and our lessons. And I can't let you go without talking about this, because I've been very, very fortunate to sit in Carol Dweck's presence when she came to London the last time. And she very, very rarely comes out to do presentations. But talk to us around how building a growth mindset and having that encouragement, how that can support a curriculum that teaches to the top.
Yeah, so it's something I only there's been a lot of so much commentary around Dweck, so I touch on it within the book, but I really what I do talk about is that she's actually sometimes a later piece of research by Heimovitz and Dweck. They talked about the way that sometimes growth mindset has kind of been misapplied a little bit, or sometimes misunderstood. And they talk about how it's important for linking praise to effort, you know, not just giving students effort-based targets, but really like linking in that praise and therefore helping them to see their capacity to develop, but also giving them that sense of that knock-on positive effect then for self-esteem as well. So I also talk about in my final chapter, it's about giving students the confidence to reach for the top as well. So I talk a little bit about that, as you say, and also more broadly, I talk about the concept of academic self-concept, which is really our own sense of how capable we are academically in relation to our peers. And it's a really interesting concept. There's so much research on how students' academic self-concept has a massive impact on their achievement. And students actually develop this in some cases as early as age 3 to 5, when they're before they've even started school, this sense of how capable they are in comparison to their peers. But it's not necessarily based on fact as well, according to some other research, and self-estimates of ability are likely to often be inaccurate, but they have this embedded sense often of their own academic self-concept. So I talk about lots of different strategies to develop that, and because if students increase their academic self-concept, then they're likely then to be able to be more empowered to improve as well. So I talk about the importance of that kind of well-directed praise. So praise, like you said with the Dweck research, encompassing effort and outcome too. And also those processes of how teachers can work to develop that relationship with students where they show that they notice and remember what they've done well, to highlight positively where students have used high-level concepts, but also to really balance the challenge in the classroom with a really high level of support and encouragement as well, and warmth too, because then students are, you know, empowered to feel that they're developing, that they're learning about these high-level concepts, that they're working at a high level, where they can, but they're also being given that encouragement as well. And I talk as well about the importance of giving students the feeling of success too. So alongside challenge, we also need to be thinking about opening lessons with, you know, accessible questions, tasks that embed confidence as well. So as I said earlier, it is all about balance and thinking about those, yes, the challenge, the desirable difficulties that we spoke about, but also giving students that confidence that they can do it as well too.
Megan, thank you so much. I've been very cheeky and kept you for much longer than I should have done, but I think so much of what you've been talking about has resonated with all of our listeners. And I think as today, as teachers and all educators are starting a new dawn, I think you've allowed us to start on such an optimistic and positive footing. Thank you very, very much for your time this morning.
Thanks so much, Lizzie. Great to chat to you. Thanks.
And to you too. And I encourage you, all of our listeners, to get hold of a copy tomorrow of Megan's book, and also to any opportunity you can follow Megan on Twitter. And if you didn't catch all of our show, I'll share a link, or just search us on TT Radio so you can listen back. I will be too. I'm just going to take an opportunity. Megan shared her Twitter link there to listen to our sponsors.
Need support with your phonics teaching? Did you know Oxford University Press now has 3 DfE validated programmes to help you? Read Write Ink Phonics, Floppy's Phonics, and the brand new Essential Letters and Sounds. Essential Letters and Sounds will get all your children reading well, quickly, using phonics books you may already have in your classroom. Developed by the Knowledge Schools Trust English Hub, it's affordable, easy to use, and makes teaching phonics with letters and sounds more effective. Whatever your school's phonics needs, Oxford has the solution. To find out more and receive support from your expert local educational consultant, visit oxfordprimary.com/phonics.
Okay, thanks ever so much, everybody, for listening and bearing with us. And we look forward to seeing you all again next week. Next week, I will be joined by Amy Staniforth, author of Ready to Teach Macbeth. We're going to be talking about teaching GCSE English literature and just chatting to Amy about her experiences as a teacher of English and an assistant principal at Icena Academy and research lead at Academy Trust. Thank you so much for joining us today. Have a fantastic day wherever you are.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.